We're going to look at the book of Philippians, four speakers, one chapter apiece. If you could find your way to Philippians, we'll start in chapter 1. You may also be aware that the conveners of this conference have given a title to each of the four chapters, and they've entitled the first one, Christ Our Life, and that is what I'm to speak on. Chapter 1 of Philippians, Christ Our Life. Now, firstly, some background concerning the writing of this letter. After all, it is a letter. A letter from the missionary who founded the church. He writes to the Christians there. Philippians, of course, were people. They were people who lived in a town called Philippi, and Philippi, let us say roughly, was in the north of Greece. Most likely, it was the first European church. Up until now, in Paul's travels, he had been in Western Asia, and then he got the call to go across into Greece. And we know the story. It's recounted for us in Acts chapter 16. We have the story of Lydia, and then there is the way they rescued that girl whose masters had used her to make money for themselves, and as a result, Paul and his friends had been thrown in jail. Out of that came more conversions, and so we have the start of the church in Philippi, a few Christians. And Paul seems to have had a special affection for these people. He stayed there for some time and then had to leave, but he revisited the place later on his following missionary journey. He revisited it, firstly as he was going out, and then he came and visited a second time as he was coming back. But that particular missionary journey ended, we might say, with an anticlimax. He went to Jerusalem, having collected a lot of money from Gentile churches to take to the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. The Jewish Christians were very poor. And Paul took this money there, thinking that this would help to unite the Jewish churches with the Gentile churches. But the whole plan backfired to some extent, and we find that Paul finished up being arrested. There was a riot. He was imprisoned in Jerusalem for a while, later on sent down to Caesarea, and for the next couple of years he had to bide his time there in jail. Finally, he had a neck full of the injustice that he was subject to, and he appealed to the emperor. And so they sent him off to Rome, a very eventful sea voyage, which is described for us in the closing chapters of Acts. And after some time, he arrived in Rome. And once again, of course, he is imprisoned for two more years. And so you put it all together, it's around about 5 years that Paul has been in custody of one sort or another. And I believe it's during that time that he writes this letter. That is, during the 2 years that he was imprisoned in Rome, which is referred to in the closing verses of the book of Acts. Now, it doesn't say in the letter that he was in Rome at the time that he wrote this letter. He may have been somewhere else. We certainly know that he was in prison because it says so repeatedly in the letter. But as you read the story of Paul, and particularly as you read his letter to the Corinthians, you find that he was imprisoned many times. He was beaten many times. Many things happened to Paul over and above the things that are recounted for us in the book of Acts. It could have been that he wrote from some other place on some other imprisonment. But it seems to me the most likely that Rome was the place where he was, and the occasion was that 2 year imprisonment referred to at the end of Acts. In fact, the word imprisonment may be not exactly the right way to word it, because he was not in the dungeons. He was, we should say, held on remand as he waited for his case to be heard. In those days, they didn't have sophisticated jails as we have today with remand sections and other sections for criminals of different calibres. But he was under house arrest, you might say. He wasn't in the main body of the jail. He lived elsewhere, but he had Roman soldiers there to guard him. And while he was there, he was visited by various people, particularly from some of the churches that he had founded in Greece and other places. And among the people who visited him was a man called Epaphroditus. And Epaphroditus had come from the church in Philippi, and he had brought Paul a gift of money, and perhaps food and clothing and other things that Paul needed. And it was to thank the Philippian church for this gift that Paul wrote this letter. Now that, you might say, was the main reason. That gave him the excuse to write. But of course, like many preachers, missionaries, letter writers, once you've had an excuse to start talking, you say a few other things while you're at it. And so he says quite a few other things, because no doubt he got snippets of information from Epaphroditus, and he felt that maybe there were some things in the church that just needed to be clarified, and he could help the Christians on their way. And so he writes this letter to the Philippians. It's a good idea that we're going all through it in one day. In fact, I'm sure that when they got the letter, they didn't spin it out over 16 weeks, but rather they probably read the thing straight off in one sitting. And it's pleasing that we can have the opportunity today to look at all four chapters together. If you just want a reference to that gift from Epaphroditus, it's in chapter 4, verse 18, where Paul says, "I have received full payment and more. I am filled, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent." So thank you very much for sending these gifts by the hand of this man. And more comments no doubt will be made on that later on. So we go back now to chapter 1, and we'll see some of the things he speaks of. As usual, he starts off by having an introduction of praise and thanks to God. As often in his letters, he starts with a prayer for the people that he's writing to. And then he recounts some of the circumstances that he finds himself in, namely there in prison in Rome. And that is really what most of the first chapter is about. But in the course of doing that, he tells the people that he really is a very optimistic spirit. He's not down on the mouth. He feels that Christ has his purpose in all of this. And he rejoices in the fact that in spite of these adverse circumstances he finds himself in, Christ is his life. And he wants to impart something of the beauty of this and something of the positiveness of this to his hearers. And those hearers, I trust, include us. Introduces himself at the beginning, Paul and Timothy, who was with him, and he writes to the church in Philippi. Goes on to talk about the grace of God in verse 2. And then from verse 3 to verse 11, he has a prayer for the Philippian church. Now let's just notice a few things about this prayer. What I'm going to do is really have a sort of running commentary. We'll just move on through these verses, reading them as we move, making a few comments and seeing what there is for us in them. And I'm reading, incidentally, from the Revised Standard Version, loosened up a little bit here and there as I take the liberty on the way through. He thanks God in verse 3 every time he thinks of these people in Philippi. He mentions in verse 4 that he prays for them frequently, and that, of course, is a very commendable characteristic of all of us, to have a frequent, positive, consistent prayer ministry on behalf of others. He thanks them particularly in verse 5 for their partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. The word partnership there is a word that crops up frequently in this letter. In the original, it was all basically one word, but we find it referred to consistently in this letter and in other letters of Paul. He talks about partnership, he talks about sharing, he talks about participation in, being partakers of having a joint participation in something. And here, of course, it is the joint participation, or the partnership, which the Christians in Philippi have with Paul, who you might say is their representative as he went out taking the gospel into other places. We hear today a lot about sharing. It's a very popular word. But I think what most people mean by sharing is something different from what the Bible means by it. Now, usually what we mean by sharing is that we sit around and we talk and we share our experiences with each other. We tell each other what happened to us. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. All I'm saying is that is not what the Bible usually means by the expression sharing. Normally, when it talks of sharing, it's not in the sense of giving things out like this, but rather in the sense of all of us jointly sharing in a thing that is common to us all. We jointly participate in something. We have communion or fellowship, all of these are the same word, in something. In the Lord's Supper, for example, we share in Christ. We jointly participate in him. Christ is our life, and this is the very thing which is central to the whole Christian experience. We share together in the gospel. And here Paul mentions that these Philippians have felt a deep commitment, sharing together with him in their commitment to the cause of Jesus Christ. And all the way through he makes references to it. In fact, in chapter 4, where I just mentioned his thanks for the gift, just a little bit before that, he says, "You share my trouble." He says, "You have entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving." You notice again, into partnership. Here again in this verse 4, Verse 5, you have partnership with me. In verse 7, he talks about we being partakers with me of the grace of God. We jointly participate in the same thing. The thing, of course, is basically Christ who is our life. Specifically here, it is the gospel of Jesus Christ to which we are committed. And notice that there's a consistency from the first day until now. It's not an off again, on again, off again, on again thing. There is a solid commitment, which unfortunately is something that many people have lost sight of today. I believe that our way of life is such that there is less sense of commitment to God and His work than there should be. That we are so used to being independent and having our leisure times and doing things as we wish to do them, that this spills over into our Christian commitment, so much so that the word commitment no longer means very much. Here we find a commitment that is exemplary, something that we could take as a pattern from the first day until now. I've been in Christian work, in full-time Christian work now for 19 years, and it's a tremendously encouraging thought, reflection, feeling to have at times when one thinks of those who have been consistent as partners from the first day until now. Paul had been at it even longer. And here again he acknowledges this consistency. If there's one thing we badly need in all our Christian work, that would have to be one of the great needs, consistent commitment. And he's sure in verse 6 that God who began this good work will bring it to completion on the day of Jesus Christ. He looks for the climax of all this at the return of Jesus Christ, and notice how he points out that the maturity, the climax that he's looking for, is something that is reached only by this pathway of commitment, this pathway of partnership together, of total commitment to God and to his cause in the gospel. And those, of course, who have that sense of obligation, that sense of commitment to the duties that have been given to them, these people can indeed look forward to the climax of that salvation when Jesus Christ returns. And so in verse 7, in view of all this, he has these warm feelings towards them. He holds them in his heart, he says, because again they are partakers with him of grace in his imprisonment and, of course, in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. Notice again, they are sharing together in something. We share together in a thing that is common to us. He then adds in verse 8 that God is his witness how he yearns for them, and in verse 9 he then breaks off into a prayer on their behalf. At the men's conference last year, when I spoke on the subject of prayer, I mentioned how I find these prayers of Paul are great patterns for us to follow. I don't want to repeat all the things I said there, except this one thing, that I have found my own prayer life helped and enriched through memorizing the various prayers, not only of Paul, but going back to the Old Testament, some of those of Moses and Ezra and Daniel and these great men of prayer, and using those as the bones around which you can put the meat to form the body of your own prayers. And you have to admit that when you look at these prayers, they do get above the mundane trivia that sometimes get us bogged down. Look what this man prays for, verse 9. He prays that their love may abound more and more. Now we can stop on that in our prayers and we can develop that. We can think of the areas where our love certainly does need developing. And so we can use that as the springboard to launch us onto some note of praise, prayer or intercession before the throne of grace. He prays also that it might abound with knowledge and discernment. A knowledge of God and his ways and the ability to know how to act correctly. So many times I get asked by people questions about divine guidance. How are we going to know God's will for us and things like this? And so many people are looking for flashing lights and magic things happening. But here what Paul is saying is that it's part and parcel of the total build-up of our Christian growth and maturity, so that as the growth goes on, we become perceptive and our mind is transformed, we are told in Romans chapter 12. We are transformed by the renewal of our mind so that we know what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. He prays that for these people, that they may have discernment. And so many Christians seem to be lacking in discernment. One gets the impression at times that of all people, Christians are just about the most gullible. We tend to believe things so easily. I know it's a good thing not to be skeptical and cynical, but on the other hand, we are called upon to exercise discernment, judgment, and not simply to swallow everything we hear. And so he says here, you may have this knowledge. Paul never plays down the role of knowledge, wisdom, or understanding. In fact, I think you find in all of his letters, it is one of the things he prays that Christians might have. And the purpose of it is not so that we can sit back and feel complacent and smug, but rather in verse 10, so that as we have this knowledge and discernment, then we can approve what is excellent. We can make the decisions and we'll know what is the right thing to do, what is the best thing to do. And then we'll be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruits of righteousness which come through Jesus Christ to the praise and glory of God. We all want to do God's will, but we've got to know it before we can do it. We all have a built-in abhorrence of people who profess something but don't practice it. And yet we must realize that before we can practice it, we must know it. We must know what we've got to do, otherwise we can't do it. And so he's saying here that as we are filled with this knowledge of God's will, so then we can approve the things which are worthwhile and excellent, and then as we do so, we will be pure and blameless for the day of Jesus Christ, and we will reach that maturity which he has spoken of earlier in this section. So you can have a reflection on that. I think it's a very rich section. And as you ponder Paul's prayer, make it a prayer for yourself, for your family, loved ones, friends, and others. Great to start a letter with a prayer, isn't it? Well, now he leads into the body of the letter, commencing at verse 12. And he talks from verse 12 to verse 26 concerning the results of his imprisonment. Now, no doubt there were many people in Philippi who were down in the dumps over Paul's imprisonment. There he was, the great apostle to the Gentiles, the man who, above all people, was well known throughout the Christian church. Probably the most famous Christian of the first century, and one might think of any century. And there he was, to all observations of people in general, there he was, wasting away in jail. And you think, well, what a waste of time this is. That's 5 years now this man's been away in jail. What a terrible waste of manpower that could be used in the cause of Christ, when we think of how Paul had been used previously, and for 5 years now he's had his hands tied. Well, he says in verse 12, cheer up, saints. I want you to know, brethren, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. It's not nearly as grim as you think. Aren't we a great lot of pessimists at times? We don't seem to be able to turn bad things into good. He says, what has happened to me, although it had the appearance of being something rather negative at first, it's turned out to advance the gospel. So much so in verse 13, that it's become known to all these people round about. He mentions various people in the Praetorian Guard and the rest of the people that were in contact with him, that his imprisonment is for Christ. He's not there simply as a rebel. He hasn't been marching down the streets with waving placards against the government and being arrested for doing wrong things. He hasn't been thieving, committing adultery or anything like that that's got him into conflict with the law. People realize that he's there not simply as a victim of circumstances or as the result of his own wrongdoing, but he's there in the cause of Christ. How do they know that? They knew that, obviously, because Paul took the opportunity to tell them. Here was a man who knew how to turn things to the benefit of the gospel so that others might profit through his experience. People, he says, are learning the gospel who wouldn't have heard it before. People are realizing that all this is in the cause of Christ. Not only that, he says, but the brethren also in verse 14, that is the other Christians there in Rome, he says, they have been made confident in the Lord because of my imprisonment, and they're much more bold to speak the word of the Lord without fear. They've taken encouragement, they've got confidence because they have seen the positive way Paul has responded. Have you ever seen those Christians that are very negative and they're always complaining? They all seem to have... Oh, you're scared sometimes to ask them how they feel, just in case they tell you. And you sometimes wonder if there's any real positive approach to life there. Not so with Paul here. His attitude to these very adverse circumstances that had befallen him is such that others are encouraged and they go away and they think it was good to have been with a prisoner. And so they're taking courage. Well, some of them anyway. Because when you come to the next verse, verse 15, you find that some of them have taken courage, but rather in the wrong way. We find that Paul wasn't popular with everybody. And we have to realize that that's one of the realities of life. If we're going to set out to be popular with anybody, well, then I think we'd better change our thinking. If we're going to do what is right, inevitably we're going to run into conflict with somebody along the road who doesn't share our vision. Paul realized that, and he didn't make any attempt to please everybody all the time. There were those around who resented Paul's leadership. They probably were jealous of his gift, and they resented the way that he had been obviously leading the early movement of the church. And there were small-minded people probably in some of these churches who found that he was a hindrance to their own aims and ambitions. Every church, well, maybe not every church, let's be generous, many churches have within them people who are selfishly ambitious, who always want to get to the top by climbing over the top of other people. And apparently there were some here in Rome like that. And of course Paul, with his straight from the shoulder approach to matters, was something of a barrier to their progress. So with Paul locked away in jail, although some of the Christians are being made bolder to espouse the cause of Christ and preach the gospel, others are made bolder in the wrong sense. They're glad to see him locked up, because now they can further their own selfish aims without having to bother about Paul trying to stop them. And he can't really stop them if he's locked up all the time. He can't get to church, he can't use his political muscle in the meetings of the church, and so they are now free to move ahead without Paul interrupting them. And so he mentions that in verse 15, that some people preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The others from goodwill, those he mentioned in verse 14. The latter do it out of love, those who preach out of good motives, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel, but the former, he says, they proclaim Christ out of partisanship. Not sincerely, thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. These are the people that are out to build their own little empires. And what's Paul's response? Well, I think it's a response that is rather more noble than the response some of us might make. Paul says, well, what then? At least they're preaching Christ, and for that I'll be thankful. Apparently these people were orthodox when it came to their belief. We find that Paul was quite intolerant of people who had unorthodox beliefs, those who misinterpreted the gospel, who had the facts of Jesus Christ distorted. He had no patience with them at all. But these people apparently are straight up and down the middle of the road when it comes to their belief in Jesus Christ and the gospel, but in spite of that, they still have this insidious jealousy, selfishness within them. And there's a little bit of it in all of us, let's be honest. And here we find that these people haven't taken that thing to the cross, and they've let it get the better of them. But at least in the process, they're still remaining true to the truths of the gospel which Paul had taught. And so he says, oh, well, they might be trying to get at me, seeing I'm locked away and can't defend myself. And they might be advancing their own cause at my expense, but, well, at least he says they're preaching Christ. They're preaching the gospel, and whether it's out of good motives or bad, at least for that I'll give thanks to God. It's great, isn't it, when you can always see the silver lining to the cloud. In spite of the gloom that was there, at least Paul found something there to be thankful for. You see, Christ was his life, that's why. And when he saw that people were preaching Christ, even if some of them did have wrong motives and use the pulpit as some sort of means of advancing themselves, even if they did do that, says Paul, at least they were still preaching Christ, and as long as that was being done, there was the possibility that people were going to benefit from it in spite of the frailties of the preachers. Yes, he says, verse 19, and I'm going to keep on rejoicing. Good stuff, Paul. Here he is, the man that's positive and looks ahead. You see, Christ's not dead. Christ is alive, and when Christ is alive and in people, that's what makes the difference. And so he says, I shall rejoice, because I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. Paul looks now to his release from jail. He sees that because of their prayers, he may be released. Now, Paul is confident in prayer, and I believe God wants us to be confident in prayer, but he never wants us to be cocksure. We don't have a monopoly on God, and when it's all boiled down, ultimately, God's sovereignty is God's sovereignty. The final decision is always with him. We have to bear that in mind, yet at the same time, that doesn't undermine our confidence, as far as I'm concerned. Actually, it gives me greater confidence, because at least I know that the one who is in control is the sovereign God, so that when my prayers may be ill-informed, God can reinterpret those so that the intent of the prayer might be brought out according to his will, even if some of the specific things we pray for have been prayed for out of a certain degree of short-sightedness on our part. Paul is confident of his release because these people are praying, and he has this confidence that God answers prayer. It's his eager expectation, he tells us in verse 20, that he shall not be ashamed, meaning, of course, when he's put to the test. Perhaps he was going to be dragged before some of the magistrates and cross-questioned for his faith in Christ. Whatever it is, says Paul, he prays that he won't fail when the time comes. You see, he's confident in God, but he's not cocksure. And that's what we've got to be aware of. It's one thing to have confidence. It's another thing to be overconfident, to be brash, and to think that somehow I have God on a string and I can just wriggle it and he's going to do what I want him to do. Paul is always aware of the frailties of the human flesh. And so he prays again, not simply that he'll be released, but when the trial comes, that he will not be ashamed, and that he will discharge his testimony boldly and to the glory of Christ. With full courage, now as always, Christ will be honoured in my body, whether by life or by death. And those last couple of words, or by death, just let us know that he kept his options open. He'd said in the previous verse or two that he's confident that God will deliver him, but he realizes in the back of his mind that he still doesn't know the future, and he says, even if I do die, well, I pray that I'll still honor Christ in my death just as much as in my life. Because after all, verse 21, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And that, I would imagine, is the verse that our conveners lighted upon for the title of this chapter. For me to live is Christ, he says. To go on living is to enjoy Christ more, to enjoy fellowship with him more, to enjoy the service of Christ more. Paul had no regrets about life. He was a man that was full-blooded in his enjoyment of it, and he says, for me to live is Christ. And even if I die, well, he said, I still gain because I go to be with Christ, which is far better, which he talks about in the following verses. He says, verse 22, if it is to be life in the flesh, that is, if I'm to keep on living here, if I get discharged from jail and I go on further journeys, well, that means fruitful labour for me. Yippee, says Paul, I'd love to be out of here and really back on the boat again, sailing across the seas to Crete or Ephesus or somewhere and engaging in further Christian service. That would be great. If, on the other hand, he says, I'm executed, well, that would be great too, because I'll go to be with Christ, which is really better than being here in this world. So he says in verse 22, if it's life in the flesh, well, good, that's fruitful service for me, but I can't quite make up my mind what to choose between, he says. My desire, my deepest desire, really, he says, is to be with Christ, to depart and to be with Christ. That's far better. But verse 24, to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Feet on the ground, that's the approach. Thoughts on the life to come, being with Christ, they may encourage us, but never let us use them as some means of escapism from the realities of life. There are tough decisions we have to make. There are unpleasant circumstances we've got to face up to, and it's not good enough simply to sit back and say, oh, well, when we're in the glory, it'll all be over. Well, maybe it will be, but that still doesn't excuse me from facing up to the situation I find myself in right now. And you find that the Bible writers never use the hope of the glory with Christ as some sort of cop-out, as some sort of excuse for evading the responsibilities of life now. How many times have you been at a Bible discussion, or I've been at a Bible discussion, we've been discussing something and all very learnedly sharing our thoughts, and we get into some problem concerning society or some social ill that happens to plague us, and then somebody will come out with the comment to end all comments by saying, well, it'll all be gone in a future day and we'll all be with Christ, and we say, that's good, we all nod our heads, and that's the end of the discussion. And so we can shelve that problem for the time being, because one day it's all going to be put right. Well, that's good. At least you've got that motivation that one day it will be put right. But it's all too easy for us simply to use that as an excuse for avoiding this very unpleasant thing that we've got to handle right now. Now Paul says, I would rather be with Christ. That's far better. But he says, to remain here is more needful for you. For you. It was other people he thought of. Not what was best for him, going to be with Jesus and enjoying the bliss of the afterlife. He said, I have a responsibility for other people here. And therefore, when he comes to earth with that thought in verse 24, he goes back to what was his former thought, namely, that he's not going to get executed, that surely God is going to deliver him so that he can continue on his fruitful Christian service. So to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account, verse 25, and convinced of this, therefore, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glorify in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. My coming to you again, that re-emergence of optimism as he believes that their prayers will be answered. But notice again how he is concerned for the ongoing development. There's too much talk simply about making decisions and we're safe and secure now, we're on the right side, we're not going to fall into the fires of hell, and people just settle back and think that that's it. But notice how in every one of Paul's letters he talks about pressing on, every man being presented mature in Jesus Christ. And here it is again. He wants to go on for their progress and joy in the faith. And if there's no progress in our lives, well, there's something wrong. And if I can't think back to this conference last year and think to myself over these previous 12 months, have I come anywhere in my Christian life? And if I can't see that I have come somewhere, well then I think I have much cause to be very concerned about my spiritual condition. We simply cannot settle down and rest on our laurels. Constant progress, says Paul, constant upbuilding. And that really concludes his introductory section. From verse 27 then, we get on to the body of the letter. And he starts in verse 27 to talk about an issue which is going to be developed in chapter 2. Now the people who made the divisions in the Bible were well-meaning, but of course they didn't consult me or other learned people here. And sometimes we get the impression that they put the division in a place which was inappropriate. I think it would have been much better to have make that the end of chapter 1 and then start chapter 2 at verse 27 of chapter 1, because really the remaining verses of chapter 1 flow straight onto chapter 2. Incidentally, the chapter and verse divisions have nothing whatever to do with the writing of Paul. Paul didn't put them there, so you don't feel that you're trampling on the Bible or something when you like to ignore chapter or verse divisions. As I say, they were put there by well-meaning people some years ago, fairly recently actually, in the overall view of the history of the Bible. And in most cases they have been helpful, but not all cases. So commencing in verse 27 now, he talks about the manner of life of the Christians. And apparently the manner of life of some of the Christians in Philippi wasn't all that it should have been. There was a certain amount of friction, a certain amount of jealousy. Wherever you get people living together, you're going to get these problems. And the church, of course, is no exception. So he starts off by reminding them that their whole manner of life must be worthy of the gospel of Christ. Christ is our life, and our lives are to reflect Christ. They're to be worthy of the gospel of the grace of God who has called us through Christ. So that he says, whether I come and see you, he's still hopeful you see, or else I'm absent, I may hear of your affairs that you stand firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. And one gets the impression from that they weren't exactly of one spirit and of one mind. A certain amount of tension, a certain amount of friction in the church, some of the believers not quite getting on with other believers, a bit at sixes and sevens with each other. And now he urges them to strive together with one spirit and one mind, with one purpose in the cause of the gospel. And don't be frightened, in verse 28, by the opponents. Apparently they were persecuted. And he mentions here that the persecution of the opponents really can be turned to good. That when the opponents see the way the Christians withstand the persecution, they, the opponents, will tend to get a little bit frightened. He talks therefore in verses 28 and 29 of the fact that Christians who live righteously in Jesus Christ can expect a certain degree of opposition from time to time. Jesus told his followers that. He said, if they persecuted me, then you can expect similar treatment to greater or lesser degree. And what Paul says in verse 28 is this: don't be frightened at anything by your opponents. This is a clear omen to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. He's saying here that when a Christian stands firm in the face of persecution, it has a twofold effect. It gives the persecutors an uneasy feeling. He says here it's like an omen of their destruction. They'd much rather you cave in. They'd much rather that you did what they wanted to do. But when they see the Christians stand firm and not give in, it makes them very shaky themselves. And it makes them realize that they're up against more than simply a stubborn person. They're up against something which they can't handle. There's a spiritual power here which is more than they can grasp. And so he says that when you stand firm in the face of persecution, it is a sort of warning to the persecutors of future judgment. It's an omen to them of their destruction, to use Paul's words. On the other hand, he says, it is also a sign of your own salvation. And I'm sure that any one of us who at any time has stood for Christ in conditions which have been opposed to Christianity, and we've all struck circumstances of one sort or another, where we've had to stand for our faith in the face of opposition from those who don't believe, I'm sure that every one of us will testify that when it's all over and gone, although we may not have enjoyed the experience at the time, when it's all over and done with, we feel strengthened and we feel more assured than ever of our salvation. Paul says, don't drop your bundle when these things happen. Stand firm, and it will not only be a warning to them, but it will strengthen you. After all, he says in the second last verse, it has been granted to us for the sake of Christ, not simply to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. Paul talks a lot about the glory of Christ, but he also speaks of the suffering which preceded it, and so does almost every other writer of the New Testament. The way to victory, ever via the path of suffering. Jesus Christ, the suffering servant, the path he trod, and he calls his followers to tread it also. And so it was with Paul. He says to these people in Philippi, you are engaged in the same conflict which you saw and now hear to be mine. Once again, that sense of partnership, the same conflict, they're sharing together in the same thing, and this, he says, is what life in Christ really is. Yes, Christ is our life, and when he shall appear, then we shall appear with him in glory. But in the meantime, we have responsibilities. I trust that we're as positive in facing those things as Paul was. And we can be as positive as he was, because the same Christ who was alive and working in Paul is the same Christ who's alive and working in you and me.